From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point, another mass shooting in America. This one yesterday in the newsroom of the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland, where a gunman shot dead five people. Staff writer Celine Sanfelice survived the attack.
I'm going to need more than a couple days of news coverage and some thoughts and prayers, because it's our whole lives have been shattered.
Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote on a number of key decisions from abortion rights to gay marriage, will retire. President Trump is set to nominate a replacement to push the court to the right.
I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy.
And a shocking upset for establishment Democrats in Tuesday's primaries. 28-year-old Democratic Socialist Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez beat out incumbent House Representative Joe Crowley in New York.
This victory belongs to every single grassroots organizer, every working parent, every mom, every member of the LGBTQ community. Every single person is responsible for this.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us on air or online. What are your thoughts, emotions after the terrible news from the Capital Gazette yesterday? Join us anytime as well at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is James Holman. He's national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and he writes the Post's flagship newsletter, The Daily 202. James, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
Also joining us from Washington is Jackie Kucinich, Washington Bureau Chief for the Daily Beast. Jackie, great to have you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, is with us. Hello, Jack. Happy Friday.
Hello, Anthony, James, and Jackie.
So, folks, let's start with this terrible tragedy in Annapolis, Maryland, the latest victims of gun violence. A gunman apparently harboring a personal grudge against the newspaper shot his way into the Capital Gazette newsroom and killed five people in this small regional paper. James, let me start with you. What's the latest on this story?
So, Jared Ramos, the alleged gunman, had been harboring a resentment against this newspaper for years. They wrote a newspaper story in 2011 about about harassment that he was convicted of. He sued for defamation, lost. He's made a lot of threats against the newspaper over the years. He's going to be arraigned on Friday for the murders of five employees of the newspaper. Obviously, just immense pain and tragedy here at the Washington Post. A lot of us have covered Maryland and so knew some of these people. There's an increased police presence outside the Washington Post headquarters on Friday. It's very sad all around.
It really is. I want to just read the names of the five people. Rob Hyacin, Wendy Winters, Rebecca Smith, Gerald Fishman, and John McNamara. The attack appears to be among the deadliest attack on journalists in U.S. history. Jackie, what are you thinking about as we think? I mean, we come to these stories again and again and again, victims of mass shootings. But what are you thinking about this morning?
You know, I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention that they got a paper out today. The remaining individuals who were there to cover their colleagues' murders were able to put out a paper today. And the other thing is that their opinion page, if you get a chance, if you're online today, look it up, because it really is heartbreaking. It's blank. And it just has a note saying that, you know, they're mourning those who were lost. And then tomorrow they'll go back to having an opinion page. But just that poignant reminder of journalists just doing their jobs. And this happens, as you said, it happens when feels like a new mass shooting, every other week. But the other thing, it happens in a climate where reporters are threatened all the time, there's a lot of rhetoric coming from a lot of different places, particularly the White House. I'm not assigning blame or anything like that, but I think My colleagues would agree that when this happened, it's something that we've all sort of feared as the rhetoric has been ratcheted up against the press. And there's been this sort of sinking feeling that something like this was going to happen. And we don't know all the details about this person's motivations. He has not been cooperating with police, according to some of the press coverage this morning. And we'll know that. But I think this is also, another reason to just take a minute and be kind to each other. And maybe to the extent that you can, ratchet back the rhetoric.
Right. Jack Beatty, what are you thinking about? Terrible, terrible story out of Annapolis.
Indeed, and we don't want to follow Sean Hannity, who seemed to have blamed Maxine Waters for this. We don't want to say that this is Mr. Trump's fault. It certainly isn't. There doesn't appear to be any connection. Nevertheless, to pick up on Jackie's point, the climate of opinion against journalists, the incitement by the president against journalists is unprecedented. I mean, just looking at some of the headlines over the year, past 3 years, he's called enemies of the people, sick people. I really think they don't like our country. They're trying to take away our history and our heritage. At Trump rallies, reporters have been pushed around in California. A reporter and two photographers from the Orange County Weekly were roughed up by a Trump crowd. At another rally, there was someone with a T-shirt, "Rope Tree Journalist." That was on a T-shirt. And this is an insidious campaign by the president to discredit the people who are going to bring the news that could loose his hold on office, and that climate is unprecedented. Mm. We have never had this, and it's even had a business side to it in his attacks on Amazon and Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post.
All good points. We want to stress again, though, that there's no evidence that the killer was influenced by any of this, but all fair points. I was struck by this. I'm just going to conclude this part of our conversation. The Baltimore Sun editorial, "The fear journalists feel today is no different from the one high school students felt after Parkland or clubgoers felt after the Pulse or people at music festivals felt after Las Vegas. The truth is nowhere can feel safe anymore." So with that, let's move on. There are other stories, big stories, that happened this week, lots of news. So let's move on and talk about the announced resignation of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. This, of course, means President Trump has a chance to nominate a second justice and push the court further to the right, which could lead eventually to the reversal of Roe versus Wade, a setback for national abortion rights, among other things. And it means a supercharged political battle. So I want to talk a little bit about that. James, let me start with you. Where does this supercharged political battle go? How are you seeing it playing out?
Anthony, it's already breaking into the midterm elections. On Thursday night, there was a gubernatorial debate in Florida between the two Republican candidates there. The hosted aired on Fox News. The first debate was, should Roe v. Wade be overturned? Both candidates essentially said yes, Democrats immediately jumping on it. Thursday night at the White House, President Trump summoned five senators who could be key to determining the outcome. Two of them, Republican women, Susan Collins from Maine, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who support abortion rights. The other three are Democrats who voted for Neil Gorsuch last year and are up for reelection this year in states that the president carried by double digits. All three voted for Gorsuch. All three are going to be under immense pressure from their own base not to support whoever the president puts up, but they're also going to be under immense pressure to support the nominee in these very red states. So it's already an issue that's on the airwaves. There are already commercials focused on the Supreme Court vacancy running in these red states, and it's going to really upend the summer. Any hope for a quiet summer in Washington is gone. We're going to see who the president puts up. He has said he's going to pick someone from the list of 25 that he released during the campaign, all judges. Yesterday, both Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins said in interviews with the Post that they think the president should pick someone who's more moderate from outside that list of 25. The one name that's getting a lot of mention that we hear Trump is looking at is Mike Lee. He's a Republican senator from Utah. He's very, very anti-abortion, but the feeling in the White House is that perhaps perhaps Collins and Murkowski would be reluctant to vote against him because he's one of their colleagues.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of tape from the news this week. After Justice Kennedy announced his retirement Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would confirm the next justice within the next few months.
The Senate stands ready to fulfill its constitutional role by offering advice and consent on President Trump's nominee to fill this vacancy. We will vote to confirm Justice Kennedy's successor this fall.
And here's Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts at a rally outside the Supreme Court yesterday following Justice Kennedy's retirement announcement.
Donald Trump is not king. No one makes it to the Supreme Court without going through the United States Senate. And in the United States Senate, everyone has a vote.
Jackie Kucinich, no one can deny that, but do Democrats have a prayer? Is there a sort of Hail Mary play here that they can put into action to try to oppose this?
I mean, she's not wrong. They do have a vote. It's just Republicans have more votes than them right,
right.
now.
And it's an incontrovertible factor.
I mean, it's just math. And the other thing that they have working against them is the fact that Harry Reid changed the rules and it only requires 51 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice. That is one of the you're hearing a lot. You know, when he changed the rules, you kind of heard Mitch McConnell say, "You're going to be sorry." And they are, because they really don't beyond a lot of, hand-wringing and speechifying. There really aren't a lot of tools for Democrats to block this nominee. And the other thing, and James alluded to this, and the money that is going to be poured into this. You already have Judicial Crisis Network, $1 million, millions and millions of dollars that are going into the midterm, that are going to be around the midterm elections.
Yeah, Jackie, hold that thought. We'll pick it up after the break. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Did the Supreme Court get it right on the travel ban or on labor unions? Following the judge's order, will the Trump administration do what's necessary to reunite migrant families? Those are some of the other stories we're going to be talking about after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. We're discussing the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Do you support President Trump's plans to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin next month? Has the FBI handled the Russia investigation fairly? With me are James Holman, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Jackie Kucinich, Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And before the break, we were talking about Justice Kennedy stepping down and the political battle ahead. Let's take a couple of calls. Mike is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony, and thanks so much for taking my call. And let me just say, we're going to miss you. The Charlotte affiliate is not going to have you anymore. And boy, we have loved having you guys down here, and y'all really set the table for weekend news chat.
Well, thank you for that, and I'm sorry we'll be leaving you. But go ahead, Mike. What's your question about the week in the news?
But I can listen online. My question is, I'd love the panel's thoughts on the chances of the Democrats pulling one Republican over in this battle ahead on Kennedy's replacement, particularly with so much at stake regarding reproductive rights. They've got now a count of 49, and with John McCain being out of the picture, they need one more. So can a Lisa Murkowski or a Susan Collins or anyone else for that matter, doesn't have to be a female, join the 49 solid Democrats to say, hold on, this is long-term, this is serious stuff.
Got it, Mike. Yeah, let me put it, Jackie, you were talking a little bit about this before the break, and it seems like the complication for Democrats is there's some conservative red state Democrats, so it's not necessarily just about pulling one Republican over, right?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that there are Democrats, it's very unlikely that they're going to vote as a monolith for a Supreme Court justice, particularly when you're talking about a Heidi Heitkamp, a Joe Manchin from these red states that President Trump Trump won in 2016, they're a lot more at risk. I mean, Democrats have to worry about holding onto their own versus pulling over a Lisa Murkowski or a Susan Collins. So they have bigger problems than it seems. I guess to answer your question, I think it's unlikely.
Right. Let's take another call. Paul is calling from Boston. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering about the panel's thoughts on what I'm about to describe. So the common wisdom is that if you're Republican, you want to push through this nomination as quick as possible before the midterms. I was wondering about the strategy of waiting. The reasons for that is that we know the polls were deemed incorrect because the Republicans came out in record numbers for the Trump election and the exit polls. The common reason was they were so energized by Gorsuch. Here, it seems fairly low risk. The Republicans will probably keep the Senate. But what about the idea of, for the sake of trying to get the House and energizing the base, they wait?
That's a really interesting idea. James, I wanted to sort of, that's a question that I had on my mind. Who has helped most in terms of igniting the base, Republicans or Democrats, around this issue?
I think Republicans. Republicans tend to get more activated and worked up about judicial nominations than Democrats do historically. That was certainly the case in 2016. It might be a little bit different this time. I think because there's such an enthusiasm advantage working in the Democrats' favor in 2018, this helps even it out a little bit. There are certainly some Republican strategists that think, heck, let's wait until after the election. That will actually help us go after Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who didn't vote for Neil Gorsuch. Those three senators we've already mentioned, there are 10 Democratic senators up for election this year in states Trump carried in 2016. But from a purely political, from a purely power standpoint, Mitch McConnell knows that this is a legacy defining thing, that really this is the first time since George H.W. Bush appointed Clarence Thomas to replace Thurgood Marshall that a president has the chance to truly change the orientation of the court, to tip it really a lot in one direction. And they don't want to risk losing that or blowing that somehow. There, it's very, 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 very difficult to imagine Democrats winning the Senate. But there is a scenario where in a bank shot, they win in Nevada, Arizona, and Texas, and they're able to hold the red states that they have to defend. And in that case, that would very much constrain the kind of nominee the president could put up.
Mm. I want to make sure we leave time to talk about a couple of big Supreme Court cases this week. The court upheld President Trump's travel ban. It also dealt a blow to unions, ruling that public sector employees do not have to pay union dues, even if they're benefiting from collective bargaining. So let's talk about the travel ban first. 5-4 ruling. Justice Kennedy, by the way, providing that fifth vote, gave broad leeway to presidential authority. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld President Trump's travel ban. Let me come to you, Jack, with your thoughts on the significance of this big decision.
Well, let me just put it in a political context, if I may, since we are talking about the midterm elections. If Merrick Garland, the President Obama's appointee, who was balked by Mitch McConnell, if he had been appointed to the court, it would be a 5-4 liberal majority. He wasn't appointed to the court because the Republicans controlled the Senate. The Republicans controlled the Senate because in the midterm election of 2014, which was an anemic turnout generally, about 35%, but the Republican base turned out, and something like 6 or 7 or 8 senators, GOP senators, were swept in, and the Senate was lost. And the Democratic base didn't turn out because one of the hidden stories, I think, of our time in politics is the demobilization of the Democratic electorate that took place under President Obama. Remember, he was elected with this wave of popular organizing. In fact, there was Organizing for America, it was called. That was going to be the vehicle for a liberal movement to match the conservative movement. It was disbanded by the White House. And something similar happened with Hillary Clinton in 2016. The Democratic Party's resistance to populist energy is in part responsible for these decisions we've just had and for this conservative court.
Interesting. Well, little tape from the news from this travel ban decision. Here's Isra Chaker, a refugee campaigner with Oxfam America, on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday, sharing her reaction to the travel ban decision.
This ban prevents me from being reunited with them in my home, the United States of America, where I was born and raised proudly as an American. They have already had to miss my graduation with my bachelor's degree, my graduation from my master's program, and the day I married the love of my life. How many more life moments and milestones will they have to miss?
Emotional reaction there from someone who's talking about missing her relatives in Syria because of this decision. But Jackie Kucinich, this travel ban, the president called it a moment of profound vindication. This was a huge win for him, right?
This was a huge win. We should remind everyone that this was the third iteration of the travel ban. The first one wouldn't have passed muster. The president wasn't happy with the second and third iterations. I think he called them weak. I don't have the tweet up on my screen at the moment. That said, this was about presidential power.
Yep.
And the Supreme Court it ruled that the president does have the power to do what he did. That's it. And I think there is some concern. I've been hearing it in the immigration activist community that this is going to embolden the president to do even more on immigration and restricting legal and illegal immigration coming into the country from other places. So I think that that is something when people are looking forward that I know a lot of the activist community are keeping an eye on.
Let's move on and talk about the other big Supreme Court decision today. This was a blow against organized labor. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Wednesday that government workers who choose not to join a union cannot be charged for the cost of collective bargaining. The vote, 5-4, Justice Samuel Alito wrote the majority opinion with the court's conservatives joining him. James, let me come to you on this one. What's the effect of this ruling? Because so much of the news, so many of these talk about these decisions were sort of buried in other news this week.
True.
But this was a big, big decision.
Yeah, Anthony, it's hard to overstate what an impact this will have on public employee unions. AFSCME, which is the biggest, projects that it will lose tens of thousands of members. The National Education Association thinks that it may lose 20% of its members that pay dues this year. And this is really important politically because the Democratic Party gets a lot of its financial support from organized labor, sometimes in a way you don't necessarily see, that they send money to various outside groups and that spend on independent expenditures, not just TV ads, but field organizing. And so if they have less dues, then they'll have less political potency. We've seen that in Wisconsin, where Scott Walker, all those protests back in 2011 were related to sort of going after union power, and they were effective for Republicans in reducing the power of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. And something similar could happen nationally. It's something the union leaders are really panicking about. This was sort of a decision that we anticipated. The court deadlocked 4-4 on this when there was the vacancy that was left open on the court, and everyone assumed Neil Gorsuch would offer the fifth vote. Indeed, he did, and now we'll see how it plays out.
Well, the plaintiff in this case, Mark Janus, challenged a requirement that government workers who opt out of a union still had to pay partial dues to cover various union costs. After Wednesday's Supreme Court decision, John Tillman of the Liberty Justice Center, which helped represent Mark Janus, applauded the court's decision.
Who should be in charge of their relationship with the union? Should the worker be in charge, or should the government union be in charge? And today, workers all over the country, 5 million, were freed because the court decided the workers should be in charge. And that is how it should be.
Listeners, we're talking about a week in the news. We're talking about big decisions by the Supreme Court on unions, on the travel ban. We're talking about Justice Kennedy stepping down. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about immigration, chaos at the border, other subjects. What's your big story this week? What questions do you have for our panelists? Jackie, I'd love to stick just for one more question about this Supreme Court decision on union dues. Unions have been losing more and more power as the years have gone by. Public sector unions were the unions that were sort of retaining what power unions still had. But this deal is a big blow to public sector unions, right?
Certainly. And, you know, I'd want to mention one other piece of this. And I know we're going to talk about the election in New York a little bit later in the hour. But one of the things I was hearing, I was on the Hill this week, and I was hearing from Democrats is there's a need to look at how they're raising money because of the fact that unions have been so disempowered. They're worried about that. They're worried about corporate money, taking that because their base is rejecting this. So not only is it going to have these wide-ranging effects on unions, but you know who unions give to. They're really doing a lot of soul searching as a result of this, and you know several other things that happened this week.
All right, let's take a call on this subject. Lorraine is calling from Tampa, Florida. Go ahead, Lorraine. You're on the air. Thanks for calling. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I'd like to know if it's possible to exclude the workers from collective bargaining who choose to not participate in the union. If they don't pay dues, why do you have to negotiate for them?
In other words, would it be possible to exclude them from the benefits of collective bargaining if they opt not to pay dues? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, because I think that at this point you have to. I mean, it might mean a new law or something. But I mean, that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Who wants to take James? Can I put that question to
absolutely.
You? Yeah, go ahead.
There are various laws that especially for public employees would prevent that. For example, I mean, you can't when the government is setting wages for employees of the Social Security Administration or whatever, you can't give one wage to the union workers and one wage to others. You can do that in right to work states and in private relationships, but it's harder when you're talking about public employees to have a different wage scale. But you may see a push to do that more and more to change some of those existing statutes.
Interesting. Really interesting call, and thanks for that answer, James. Let's move on and talk about immigration. Lots of news this week. The House soundly rejected a GOP immigration bill that would have funded Trump's border wall, offered young undocumented immigrants a path to citizenship, and partially addressed the family separation crisis on the border. That vote was 301 to 121. It came right after President Trump urged passage of the bill with a tweet that we want strong borders and security, the president tweeted. What's the significance of this defeat? Jack, let me come to you with this.
Well, I don't think that anything was going to come out of the House that would solve this problem because it seems to be an issue that Republicans want, the issue of being tough on the border, being tough on immigrants, being even cruel seems to be, the president has said, this is an issue we want. And he was ambivalent about the bill at best. But, you know, the question is, Dianne Feinstein this week said about this, this is a manufactured crisis. Previous presidents have found ways to enforce our immigration laws without separating children from their parents. An article in the New York Times on Sunday, entitled Don't Put Families in Cages, pointed out what one previous president did, that is President Obama. He started a pilot program in January of 2016, a family case management program that released families, parents and children, seeking asylum and monitored their progress in the United States through case managers. And the result was the pilot program had 700 families in it, and it was a huge success. 99% of these people turned up for their hearings. In other words, the usual thing is, well, if you let them go, they won't turn up for the hearings. This case management program had 99% success. And it cost $36 a day as opposed to the something like $900 a day, which is now for the price of jailing people. The pilot program, of course, was stopped by the Trump administration. But the point is, there is a way to deal with this and deal with it successfully. The pilot program shows how.
Yeah,
I've got a little bit of reporting on that.
Go ahead, Jackie. Jackie, we have like 20 seconds before break, but go ahead, and then we'll pick up after the break.
No problem. So one of the reasons that ICE, we did some reporting on this, ICE ended the program because not enough people were being deported. Too many people were getting asylum. So that's one of the reasons it ended.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to pick up more on this subject after the break. You can join the conversation, listeners. What are your midterm predictions after Tuesday's primaries? What does the victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez mean for the Democratic Party? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. In other news this week, East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosenfeld was charged with criminal homicide Wednesday in the fatal shooting of a 17-year-old Antoine Rose. Here's Allegheny County District Attorney Steve Zappala.
I find that Rosenfeld's actions were intentional, and they certainly brought about the result that he was looking to accomplish.
Also this week, German soccer fans shed tears as their defending champion team crashed out of the World Cup with a loss to underdog South Korea Wednesday.
It feels like the end of the world. It's certainly the end of the World Cup for Germany.
Low lives and lost souls were just two of the phrases with which President Trump labeled late-night comedians this week. Rival hosts Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, and Conan O'Brien teamed up with this cold open rebuttal.
Did you see Trump's rally last night?
Nope.
Me either. Heard he said some pretty bad stuff about us.
Really? That doesn't sound like him.
I heard he said we're all no talent, low life, lost souls.
Well, that's not right. That's Conan. Hold on. I'll get him.
You can join the conversation. What do you make of protesters confronting Trump administration officials in restaurants or on the street? Do you think it's an appropriate form of protest? Or is it contributing to a breakdown in civility all around? With me are James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Jackie Kucinich, Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And folks, before the break, we were talking about the House rejecting a GOP immigration bill. The vote against the bill came as a federal judge in San Diego on Tuesday ordered the government to quickly reunite migrant children with their parents. This was in response to an injunction sought by the ACLU. So, Jackie, let me come to you on this. I mean, can the administration even comply with this? Is it even possible to get these families reunited within just a few weeks?
This is what happens when you implement a policy without a plan. And we're seeing that play out on these children's faces, you know, who are, the audio from ProPublica, there were pictures that were apparently from one of these centers that were out this week, I think through Michael Avenatti, of all people. It doesn't seem right now like the government has the ability to do this particularly quickly. Because they haven't presented us with a plan. We keep on asking the questions. A lot of these, there are some people who have been deported and their children are still here. We're hearing these awful stories about people saying about, you've officials saying that you're going to be, either you are deported or we're going to take your kid away. I mean, it's some really, and I don't think it's going to get better before it gets worse. Because there is no plan to reunite these people.
Really interesting. Let's take a call on this question. Merrill is calling from Dowelton, Tennessee. Merrill, good to have you. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. My question is, what are the consequences for the administration if these children are not reunited within the time period that is mandated?
It's a good question. The court order says all migrant children separated from their families have to be returned within 30 days, 14 days for children under five. James, what about Merrill's question? Are there consequences?
Yeah, in theory, you could be held in contempt of court. If they show that they're making a good faith effort to comply with the court order, the judge, I think, will be kind of tolerant of that. You do have to comply with the court order, though. The issue is, one of the things we've learned this week, amazingly, is that they deported a lot of these parents and sent them back, in some cases, to Mexico. And the kids are still in detention, and the government literally can't find the parents. This is just how kind of unthought through this was. And so you have kids who are being held as wards of the state right now, whose parents were taken away from them and are now gone, and the government doesn't know where they are. And so they're, in those cases, they're government's just simply not going to be able to comply with the court order. And I don't see the judge putting sanctions on that, but it's the reality of where we're at because of the Trump policy.
I want to move on and talk about a Russia summit happening next month. On Thursday, the White House announced President Trump will meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on July 16th for one-on-one talks. At a press conference in Moscow on Wednesday, National Security Advisor John Bolton addressed some of the concerns about this summit, which will take place, as we said, next month, the middle of next month. Here's John Bolton.
A lot of people have said or implied over time that a meeting between President Trump and President Putin would somehow prove some nexus between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin, which is complete nonsense. I don't think that's been helpful. And as I say, I think the president recognizes that there may be some criticism of this decision to have the meeting.
So the talks, a couple of things, interesting intersection here. It will follow a NATO summit meeting in Brussels. It'll also come, as Bolton was referring to there, as Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election hacking continues. Jack Beatty, what's the significance of the timing of this summit with Putin?
Well, coming right on the heels of the NATO summit, it looks like an affront to NATO. And we read that at the Quebec G7, Mr. Trump was quoted as saying NATO is as bad as NAFTA. He was also quoted as saying that Crimea is Russian because everyone there speaks the same language. And yesterday he tweeted that, again, a sort of pro-Putin tweet. The Russians say they didn't interfere. Where's the, you know, let's look into Hillary. And this comes when McClatchy last week and some Democrats this week have referenced the over $100 million in cash purchases of Trump properties over a period in the aughts, over $100 million, and I think one Democrat this week said that is being looked at as a possible money laundering scheme, and if that's found to be so, the question, what does Putin have on the president, is closer to being answered.
Well, here's President Trump the day before his administration announced a summit next month with Vladimir Putin, talking about why getting together with the Russian president is a good idea.
We will probably be meeting sometime in the not too distant future. And I've said it from day one, getting along with Russia and with China and with everybody is a very good thing. It's good for the world. It's good for us. It's good for everybody.
So, Jackie, what are you watching for as this summit comes together in just a couple of weeks?
Right. So, I mean, there will be comparisons between what he says and does at NATO versus what he does at this meeting. But also, there are some really – it's a big world out there. We want to see how they discuss Iran, how they discuss Syria. There are other things beyond Russian meddling, which, again, we haven't really seen the president go in depth with Vladimir Putin about this. I don't know if he doesn't want to offend him or what, but we need to see if that, if that is even going to be broached. We don't really have as we know, Trump is kind of his own scheduler. So we know for sure what is going to be on that agenda. But certainly they have, you know, and North Korea. How could I forget? They'll discuss that as well. So you'd think. But yeah, so just the range of topics that could be discussed at this meeting really is massive.
Well, I want to move on and make sure we leave time to talk about the earthquake that hit the Democratic Party this week in New York. That's where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 28-year-old liberal activist, ousted a top House Democrat, Joe Crowley, in the primary. Among other things, this shines a pretty big light on internal divisions within the Democratic Party. James, let me start with you on this conversation, on this part of the conversation. What's the significance of this?
It's huge. I think in 2018, Democrats are united because everyone dislikes Trump so much. But what we saw in this district, which covers Queens and the Bronx, is a real Democratic identity crisis. You have some Democrats who are out there saying we should abolish ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. That's a position that frankly is outside the mainstream. You had Joe Crowley, who's the number four Democrat in House leadership, someone who very plausibly could have replaced Nancy Pelosi, potentially a Speaker of the House next year. He moved pretty far to the left over the last couple of years. He embraced Bernie Sanders' proposal to have Medicare for all, but he kind of still got outflanked to the left. He's traditionally run the Queens Democratic machine, but it wasn't enough. And one of the things that I think is really interesting, because it goes back to the conversation that we were having earlier about the public employee unions and Jackie's excellent point about how Democrats on the Hill are rethinking how they raise money. One of the debates in this district, Crowley skipped, and he was in New York that night, but he was at a fundraiser in Manhattan, and he was raising money from rich Wall Street types. And so he didn't go to this debate. And that really hurt him a lot with people. The New York Times editorial board called him out for it. And I think that speaks to part of this identity crisis, which is this frustration that Democratic establishment leaders are so tied to the corporate world and to Wall Street. I think that was one of the big takeaways from this week.
Well, let's listen to some sound from a campaign video from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here she is. As we mentioned, she beat top House Democrat Joe Crowley in Tuesday's New York primary.
I'm an educator, an organizer, a working class New Yorker. I've worked with expectant mothers, I've waited tables and led classrooms. And going into politics wasn't in the plan. But after 20 years of the same representation, we have to ask, who has New York been changing for?
Jack, she mentions there, I've waited tables. In fact, she was waiting tables not long ago, and here she is on the edge of on the verge of going to Congress. What do you make of this earthquake within the
Democratic? Let me pick up the waitress thing. You know, when Paul Wellstone was elected to the Senate back in the, I guess, the early 90s, he said he was one of the few members who was going to get a raise getting the job. You know, he was a professor, and this would be a big, for almost everybody listening to my voice, we would get a big raise if we went into Congress, $150,000, $160,000 a year. And the dearth, the lack of working people there, of people who have recent contacts with what life is like in America. Just in that alone, Ocasio-Cortez brings something new. She also brings her youth to a party whose leadership is just ossified. I mean, we've said this again and again on this program, pointing out the age of the Democratic leaders. And, you know, this is the party, younger people, minority people, women. And there's an unprecedented number of women running this year for Democrats, and that's all to the good. But there has to be a changeover of leadership, and if this doesn't send a message to the leaders in the House that maybe it's time to think about retiring, they need another awakening.
Well, in the few minutes that remain, I want to talk about what can only be called a sort of further breakdown in civility in the public discourse all around. Last weekend, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders Huckabee was asked to leave the Red Hen restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, where she was dining with her family. Now, at a rally in Los Angeles shortly after that, California Democratic Representative Maxine Waters called for the continued heckling of members of the Trump administration. Here's what she said.
If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Now, in a rare rebuke, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi criticized Waters, writing that Trump's daily lack of civility has provoked responses that are predictable but unacceptable. And then President Trump upped the ante with Waters, tweeting, "Be careful of what you wish for, Max." Jackie, what is going on here? What's your response to all this? Jackie Kucinich, are you with us? We might have lost Jackie. How about James Holman? Are you with us?
Yes.
Yeah. Give me a sense of what you're seeing and what seems to be like a breaking down of the public discourse here.
It's absolutely happening. And there, I think in some ways, a lot of people who really dislike Trump are responding to what they hate about Trump by acting like Trump. And there is a race to the bottom. There is a coarsening of the discourse. I see it in my inbox every day. And it's – there's just – the civility problem is real, and in some ways it plays into the president's hands. I think that there are a lot of people who have watched the last week unfold, and they kind of it's sort of a pox on all your houses. And there's a lot of Democratic leaders. It was notable that you saw Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the two top Democrats in Congress, condemn Waters within 24 hours of those comments in Los Angeles, because they recognize that this is not the way to win in the midterm elections.
Yeah, Jack Beatty, what do you think about this? I mean, what about Maxine Waters and Democrats? Would they benefit from former First Lady Michelle Obama's advice, when they go low, we go high? It seems like everyone's going low right now.
It does. And in that competition, Donald Trump will win. You know, you could say that if Maxine Waters didn't exist, Donald Trump would invent her. Black woman, Democrat, friend of Nancy Pelosi, a target. On the other hand, you know, Renee Graham in the Boston Globe quotes Zora Neale Hurston, the playwright, writing, "If you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it." People have to speak up, but they've got to find a way to do it that's within the limits of what was understood before Trump as civility. And, you know, one of the things Anthony Kennedy did remind us of in his Colorado Bakers decision, he spoke about sort of the rhetoric of tolerance, that in a, you know, so divided a country, we have to respect one another. The divisions could get even worse.
All right. Well, on that, let's embrace the rhetoric of tolerance. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, have a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And James Holman, National Political Correspondent at The Washington Post, thank you and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Anthony.
And Jackie Kucinich, Washington Bureau Chief for The Daily Beast, thanks to her as well. Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.